Chair and Committee on Commerce and Labor, Subcommittee on Healthcare Reform. Would invite our administrator to review the agenda and pertinent issues.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Yeah, in front of you is an agenda, and the committee rules that were adopted this morning with the full committee do apply to the subcommittee, so the subcommittee will not be adopting any separate rules. And just in short, any items that this subcommittee decides that it wants to have action upon, such as the legislative contract, would have to be sent to the full committee for deliberation. The committee, subcommittee itself cannot pass anything out directly. In front of you then are your per diem sheets, and I think you've already filled some of those out with your full committee, and just hand that one in to Aaron. And then we also have a modified version of the work plan that was emailed out to you a while back. At the top says discussion for October 16th meeting that I believe Chair Morris wants to review with you at a certain juncture in the meeting. And with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Rick. Would draw your attention to the issues and the sub-issues that we have for discussion purposes. And I believe our goal today is to develop an agenda and then set the time frame for what it is that we want to accomplish. Mm-hmm. So with that, just to review briefly the primary issues, the implementation of Senate Bill 329, and the reports that are coming to the Assembly. The committee would look at these reports, review the progress, provide feedback, and examine the need for any statutory changes that may be in effect or appropriate for the February session. With respect to the healthcare workforce issue, as I recall, in our discussions in Senate Bill 329 and also in our Interim Healthcare Access and Affordability Commission, the issue of healthcare workforce was touched upon, but it was not dealt with in substantial depth. And the question would be, if we're successful in achieving universal access, do we have the workforce to deliver the services? And to look at some issues surrounding that. The third issue is the health information technology. As we know, this is an evolving process. Are there issues that we should be looking at that we could help facilitate in that regard? The fourth issue is medical malpractice, something that is always on the agenda, but seemingly little progress is made. But that's a very significant issue with respect to the cost of health care and its influence on physician practices. And then a fifth issue Rick and I had been discussing that was not on previous distribution with the committee, and that is to look at the relationship between healthcare providers, insurers, and the payers to better understand that relationship with the perspective of looking at the third-party competitive structure, and if we're going to look at making healthcare more affordable, is increasing competition a consideration of how do we remove barriers to increase greater competition from local perspectives. So those are the five primary issues, colleagues. Comments? Discussion?
This is significant.
I would add a few points to it, but that's good.
If we can address this, you know, in addition to having to, you know, put up with Barney, then we've... Oh, he was here. I didn't see him.
Yeah, sorry, Barney. You know, this is a significant agenda. I like it a lot.
Everybody?
Chair, I like it too. I particularly like it because I think there's two areas you've touched on here that 329 really didn't speak to very well, and there's just, you can't get everything into one bill. One is a healthcare workforce, and I think it's a very important issue, especially when you think that some of the workforce we're looking at takes a long time to go from education to the street. You know, physicians 10 to 12, 14 years. Nurses and techs take a long time too, and so I think focusing that is great. As far as implementation of Senate Bill 329, would you entertain the possibility of having some of the subcommittees give us a report also? Do we have time to do that in the meetings we're going to have?
Rick, I defer to your comments on that.
Yeah, in terms of the actual number of meetings, and again, this is a fairly considerable work plan. Right now, the subcommittee will probably meet after this, perhaps two more times before the February 08 session. At that point, I believe the Senate President is going to probably want to revisit committees, subcommittees, composition, and then make some kind of decisions in terms of who would meet after February and how many times. So I think at this point, it's good to try to map out a pretty ambitious agenda, because, you know, if we get into February 08 especially, there may be time for the subcommittee to actually meet more regularly. There, we may not have as many bills to...
Well, thanks for correcting me. I assumed, and I should not have assumed, that this subcommittee will continue one way, shape, or another after the February session. We need to continue to follow very carefully what the Oregon Health Fund Board is doing. I've made an assumption we'd be continuing after February. Maybe I shouldn't have. So I need to have that conversation with Senate President and others. I mean, we absolutely have to have legislative oversight in connection with the Health Board. We can't afford not to. So that has to continue in some way, and we'll need to have that conversation.
My assumption was that this was an interim committee that would carry through to the 09. If that's something different, then obviously this work plan is far too aggressive.
And having subcommittee reports after February was what I was thinking of. I didn't expect any before then. They haven't had a chance to do the work yet. But I'd like to have some feedback from them directly to us, if we could, if you think it's appropriate. So let's leave that. The other thing I wanted to talk about was number five here, which is right on target, the dynamics between providers, insurers, and payers. And I'd add one more bullet point to that. It's something I've been trying to track down and have had some difficulty doing, and that is, how do we set rates between primary care and subspecialty care and specialty care? And the nearest I can find is, it appears that Medicare puts those rates out annually, and then the commercial market follows those rates about a year later. That's the best I can find. And I think having that discussion, since we're trying to go to preventative and primary care, is important. I mean, you get what you pay for here. If you're not going to pay for preventative and primary care, you're not going to get it. So I'd like to add that as a bullet point, if we could.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
If I may, as I indicated earlier, I am happy to work on all of these five suggestions or items listed on the work plan. But really, it's number one. It's the relationship of this committee to the board. And really, the board and the subcommittee, you know, are what's driving this bus now. I mean, we all helped create that and gave birth to that. I see a significant function of this committee is assisting, you know, their efforts in whatever big and little ways we can, because they will, in the comprehensiveness of their charge, be taking on these other bullet points. So, you know, however, you know, we structure that dynamic, that's what we're here for, as well as to provide the liaison, the leadership, and members on a regular basis as to what's going on, which I think, implies attendance and participation by us at the board meetings and some of the subcommittee meetings. We got to know what's going on so we can help them.
We draw your attention also to bullet point, the topic number two in the bullet point, last bullet point, OHSU regional expansion funding. There were some of us within the legislature that were somewhat baffled as to why that project for regional medical expansion of the medical school into regional basis inclusive of OSU and U of O. It was a rather incredible piece of work by OHSU that did not receive funding. And to the extent that we can be of assistance, it seems to me that that's a critical piece of this workforce delivery. In addition to the nursing and the technical, but the physician shortage itself and the ability of that regional program to be responsive to those needs, I think is a very, very critical issue that possibly we could be advocates for developing that.
Question for Rick. You know, on the House side, is there a parallel committee to us that is looking at 329?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, the Representative Greenlake has the health care committee that's meeting. I don't believe they have specifically a report on their work plan yet, although at one point Representative Greenlake was discussing, saying if you'd like some updates from the health fund board. So I think that'd be the closest committee.
Okay. Are you leading to the issue of maybe joint committee?
Yeah, I am.
To hear those presentations so we don't occupy unnecessarily their time.
It would seem to me an efficient way of doing things possibly. We'd have to talk to Representative Greenlake and see if it's something we can arrange, or at least part of the committee meetings for both to be occurring at the same time so we can both hear the progress, ask questions, make sure we have good information flowing both through the Senate and the House, and maybe we could look into doing that. And we're still getting off the ground. There's not obviously a lot that's happened. They're just, from my understanding, they're doing a great job getting organized, but pretty soon they're going to be looking at some products, and I don't want to be a big shock to people on the House side because they haven't had an opportunity to hear what those products might be.
Excellent.
Can I inject something also? Just a reminder to the subcommittee that the Senate has a November 15th deadline date to get concepts in for drafting to legislative council. So even though you have some individual bills that you'll have as a committee and therefore as a subcommittee, any ideas or concepts that you want to, put on the table for the full committee to consider, we'll have to keep in mind that November 15th date is
approaching.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any other comments?
Technical question. Do we have to adopt these rules?
No. The full committee adopted the rules. These rules apply to the subcommittee.
So we adopted these rules this morning.
Right.
More applicable to the sub.
Okay. Any other comments? Discussion?
Can I ask one more question, too, of our other members? We just talked also as well as sometimes finding the right resources to address these topics can be challenging, and you might have some suggestions on people you want to have come in, agencies, or more specificity on some of these. So perhaps it's opening up to the members that if they want to hear from specific people to address any of these, to let me know. And we'll, as we start to develop the agenda, then I'll communicate with the chair on the detailed agenda.
Okay, well, if we may, we might just leave this discussion open for the next part of our agenda, and that's the update on the Oregon Health Fund Board and other states' health care reform activities. Barney and Janine, if you could join us, and then we would invite your comments also with respect to the work plan and how we can be complementary to the work that you are doing.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Barney Spade. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Fund Board.
And I'm Janine Smith, chair and members of the committee. Janine Smith, the administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research. I'm sorry, I just flew in from D.C. at midnight, so I'm half asleep.
Well, you look a heck of a lot better than Barney, so.
I just flew in from Vancouver.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, what I thought I would do is kind of give you a snapshot of where we are in getting the Oregon Health Fund Board organized and its work underway. Just to recount, the governor nominated seven members of the board in or appointed seven members of the board in mid-August. The Senate confirmed those members in mid-September. We had our first meeting of the board on Tuesday, October 2nd, in Wilsonville. It was primarily dedicated to organizational issues such as bylaws and an initial round of appointments to the five of the six committees that we'll be working through. And we've since that board meeting, we are continuing to develop at the staff level the charters, or if you will, the scope of work for each of the committees, and I'll quickly run through some of that. And we have scheduled for Tuesday, October 30th in Portland, what we're calling a mini retreat. There will be business items that the board will do, but we're also having Anne Gauthier from the Commonwealth Fund will give an overview of the Commonwealth Fund's work and study of what other states are doing and how other states compare to each other relative to having high-performing delivery systems. And then we're going to give the board some additional background material, discussion, primarily an overview of the Health Policy Commission's roadmap to reform and the Oregon Business Council's recommendations regarding health care, which serve as a point of departure for the work of the board, and some additional demographics and study of the nature and characteristics of both Oregon's insured population and Oregon's uninsured population to try to frame the work that the board and its committees will be doing kind of at a macro level. As I indicated, we are going to have six committees. They are a finance committee, a delivery system committee, a committee on benefits, a committee on eligibility and enrollment, a federal laws committee, and a health disparities committee. Let me quickly run through what we're intending those committees to at least initially work on in the time that's available. There are really two issues before the finance committee that are pretty big issues. One is what I'm calling strategic revenue options. We are working from a set of assumptions that flow from the Health Policy Commission's recommendations, namely an individual mandate to affordable coverage. If you have that, there's two things that flow from that. One is the need for some form of subsidization for individuals and families at some income level. And the other is that the individual market or the non-group market as we know it will change substantially under the operation of an individual mandate. And so that committee will be working on both those issues, one looking at strategic revenue or tax options that would help fund both the subsidies and the expansion of the Oregon Health Plan as part of that strategy. And the other would be, Bill calls out fairly explicitly about an insurance and exchange, and we're putting the work of that insurance exchange inside this what I call the market redefinition or redefining, redesigning a portion of Oregon's insurance market because of an individual mandate. The delivery system. So if that's kind of the revenue side of the move toward universal coverage, the expense side is really focused in the delivery system, and the fundamental charter is to how do we improve the effectiveness, the efficiency, the value
in Oregon's delivery system. And we've got several strategies. Many of them are called out in 329, looking at primary care or a primary care home or some transformation of primary care generally. There's a lot of work being done in this state and elsewhere that demonstrates that with kind of a reorganization of primary care and the aggressive management of chronic disease, that we can have a more efficient system, actually save some money and improve the quality. So we're looking at things like the primary care home. How do we move that forward? The state as a purchaser may have a role in moving those concepts forward. You mentioned health information technology. We have that on our list, and I'll talk a minute about it when I comment on your agenda. But the other big area is in quality and transparency. The bill calls out the recommendations from OHPR regarding a quality institute. We're actually going to take some liberty with that concept and talk about a value-based purchasing and quality institute and what could it, with broad-based and timely information in the area of cost and efficiency and effectiveness and safety, what role could it play in reshaping the market, if you will? So there's a lot of heavy lifting in the delivery area. Let me stop there and comment on two aspects. And I had talked with Chair Morse earlier that we do have, in fact, one of the first meetings I had when I returned to the state was a briefing on the workforce issue, and I indicated to Senator Morse I thought it was an important issue. I didn't know, given the breadth and complexity of some of the other issues that the delivery system would be dealing with, whether they would get to that. So from the point of view of managing the work of the board and its committees and also thinking about a comprehensive plan to be delivered in 09, I would reiterate what was said here by the members, that the workforce issue is, I think, a real strategic issue. And it's not just in the context that if we got 600,000 Oregonians or nearly all Oregonians into a health care coverage and access, but there's a crisis in the workforce in spite of that anyway, particularly in primary care, all primary care providers, physicians, nurse practitioners, etc. And there's a lot of good work being done in both higher education and the community colleges to try to address that. So I think this is an important part of a long-term strategy that Oregon needs to work on, and we would participate and help in any way we can if the committee moves forward on workforce. We have put aside for a moment the health information technology because we're working with the governor's office to understand exactly how that office wants to proceed. There was a committee that was called HISPIC, which I think the acronym is Health Information Security and Privacy, that has been working for the last couple of years. And there's an interest on the part of the governor's office of taking that committee and broadening its charge a little bit and calling it, I can never remember the acronym, Health Information Infrastructure Advisory Committee, to move beyond both the important issues of privacy and security, but into how do we rationalize and organize this emerging electronic network of moving information between providers to insurers to individuals and their personal health records. If that gets organized, that would probably be the venue in which they would be working and would help advise the board on the health information piece. They would also probably work very well in tandem with you or in consultation with you on the work that the subcommittee might do in health information technology. Benefits and enrollment are looking at reforms from the point of view of the member or of the citizen, looking at the essential questions of essential benefit or benefit packages. The uninsured are not a homogeneous group. They range widely in the income scale, et cetera. So they'll actually have their kickoff meeting tomorrow, and they're going to look at questions like what should a benefit design look like for various segments of the uninsured in various programs. What about cost sharing at certain levels? I'm very interested interested in having them make comments and study things like an evidence-based benefit design, of where we build into benefit designs more of the evidence-based practices that we know work and are preferable over others. So they'll be working on issues like that. Eligibility and enrollment will look clearly at the questions of outreach and enrollment of folks into programs. How do we make that work smoother, and particularly in populations of color and geographic isolation. And then the Federal Laws Committee, as you all know, was called out to with a very particular charge of examining the federal policies that inhibit Oregon from moving forward on the reforms that are outlined or on the goals that are outlined in Senate Bill 329. And we will have a Federal Laws Committee that does that. We will be having some hearings around the state, at least one in every one of the congressional districts. And then a report is delivered after the board approves it right now on July 31st. I am thinking about perhaps requesting that if we could have that date moved a little back, we could line up some of our deliverables in our public meetings where we didn't have kind of redundant resource deployment. And I'll talk later with you, but and then the last one is a committee that at the request of a couple of the board members and others is a health disparities committee of having a committee look at make recommendations to all of the committees, but particularly the board as it hears the recommendations from the other committees about what are some of the best practices and best policy frameworks that Oregon could employ to begin to reduce known health disparities that are either have their roots either racially or in ethnicity or in geography. The rural frontier nature of Oregon is there's health disparities that arise because of that. As I indicated, we'll have three of the committees are meeting this week. The Benefits Committee tomorrow at 9:30 at Wilsonville, and then the Finance and Delivery Committees will meet on Thursday at 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock, respectively, in Wilsonville. Again, the purpose of those first meetings will to get this is the first time the committee members will have gotten together, elect a chair and a vice chair, have some bylaws, and then we'll walk through the charter and then get organized as far as future meetings and staff. The other point that I'd make before closing is that with Dr. Smith's assistance in the OHPR professional staff, we've rounded out the team. We've just completed the recruitment of a couple of new professional staffers, health policy staffers, very talented people. And so I think within the resources that you gave us, which were modest, we do have a good team, but I think it's a team that realizes there's a lot of work to be done in 350 days. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Barney, in addition to your comments, particularly as it relates to the federal subcommittee, it was a very specific charge not only to do all of the activities that you enumerated, but also to propose, enlist the federal delegation and propose legislation to be considered at the federal level to remove some of those impediments to providing better health care. I don't want to lose sight that there is a strong federal component to this, and that we are ever mindful of proposing that legislation, whatever it may be. I don't predispose the answer, but
yeah, it is referred to as a federal-state partnership, and as a previous Medicaid, albeit short time, Medicaid director, I sometimes question the term or the definition of partnership
right
from the federal perspective. But they are and will be, and I think will continue to be, a key partner or a key player in whatever happens at any state level. And I think there's some ways that we probably could get some greater flexibility.
Yeah.
Ridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Barney, thank you very much for coming today and the work you're doing. We appreciate the fact that you're willing to come home and get the job done for us. And I know that the resources we've given you for a $20 billion industry a year, for you to make a revolution in that and change how we deliver health care is totally inadequate. It's just, from my point of view, it's shameful that this legislative assembly can think it's going to change something with that little amount of money, but Oregon does it in the back of volunteers. We'll be doing it again.
We've worked on the back of napkins before.
Yeah. Obviously, and everyone's heard that story before. I won't come back through it at the spaghetti factory. But anyway, a couple of things just real quickly, and I'm going to touch on something that Senator Westland already spoke to. I made a note as you were speaking about the federal policy situation. One was I would support very strongly moving that July date back, not only for combining the meetings, but because if we're going to be looking at significant waivers and asking for those waivers, we need 18 months to start talking about them, put the paperwork together, and start presenting it and have any chance of getting them back. So if you could move that up, I think it'd be very, very appropriate. The other issue in federal policies...
Could I clarify?
Yeah.
You said move it up, and I want to make certain that you and I are...
Before July.
No, I was...
I was going the other way.
Well,
back,
I would... I would
to September.
Then I guess we're not on the same page. Yeah. I go the other way, if you could, okay? I mean, I was thinking about time we're going to need here. If we really have an interesting and thoughtful and package that we can get through in 09 or even pieces of it, we don't need to wait a year and a half, 2 years after that to implement because we haven't been working on the waivers in a parallel universe. So I'm going to ask you to think about that, okay?
We'll talk more.
Yeah, I know you're on Warp 8 in this thing, but just hang in there with us, okay? The other discussion... the other part of that discussion, there's two other parts to it. One, I think we're walking into a golden opportunity at the federal level. When we started the last session, there was no discussion of health care as any kind of an issue at the federal level of any significance. That has dramatically changed. Is that our speaker system here?
No, I think that's wings.
Oh, that's wings. That's right. Really. Okay. Oh, well, am I hearing things?
That's my taste.
That's my... the federal level is changing dramatically, and I think they may be, as they were 20 years ago, open to new kinds of waivers. And so it's an opportunity we may be able to exploit and use here in Oregon. The last piece is very anecdotal, but talking to other physicians, I'm seeing a new trend I've never seen before as far as Medicare is concerned. I'm seeing patients being told as they turn 65, they have to find another doctor. People are being disenrolled from doctors' practices because they're turning 65, and physicians are refusing in Oregon to take Medicare patients, even patients who have been with them for 20 or 30 years. I don't think it speaks well to the profession, but it also speaks to what the problem is. So as you go around the state, I'm afraid whether you like it or not, you're going to have a Medicare discussion. It's just too big a piece not to be looking at and talking about. And we've got a real problem in the state. We've got a real problem. If everyone gets disenrolled and the Medicare patients end up in emergency rooms and safety clinics are in trouble already. Take on Medicare with the complexity of those patients is going to be a real disaster. So that's another discussion you may be having to have as you.
Well, Medicare is one of the top agenda items on the list of issues that the Federal Policy Committee needs to look at, and primarily in the area of, as we've all labored in this for over a decade, the discriminatory reimbursement practices, particularly in fee-for-service Medicare, for both physicians and institutional providers.
I understand. And the attempt by the federal government to drop out of the Advantage programs really hurts Oregon. So that's a discussion I'm sure you'll have. And I'll jump tracks just for a second and get off this. You mentioned mandates for individuals. That's something we discussed in producing 329. Everyone shies away from saying the next step after that, and that's mandate for businesses of one shape or another. A discussion of that least should occur. I know it's something politically no one wants to talk about, but, you know...
Can I comment on that?
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, because I actually, one of the working assumptions that we're going to be fairly explicit about, one is an individual mandate, and what are the consequences of that logically that have to flow. And the other is, and I wouldn't necessarily call it an employer mandate, but it is a pay-or-play system that is, in the framework of ERISA, is value neutral, state policy needs to be value neutral, whether you provide insurance or not. But I believe there's a very strong interest in looking at if an employer doesn't provide insurance, and there might be certain exceptions to types of employers, is that they should pay something into a fund that would help cover not just their workers, but others. And so that's my term of an employer mandate, is more along pay or play.
And I would tell you, I feel exactly the same way.
Okay.
I feel exactly the same way. So as long as that conversation does occur, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other comments?
I don't think so right now.
Well, thank you.
I covered everything.
Do I understand, Dr. Smith, you have been traveling?
Yes, Senator Morse and the committee. We actually, a group of us went 2 weeks ago to Chicago by invitation as one of 14 states that are looking at health care reform sponsored by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And it was an excellent opportunity for interaction with the states, although we have had some ongoing conversations and meetings where you kind of have a general feel. This was kind of all of us in the same room having to share with where people were. There's probably about 8 to 10 of those states that are really kind of down the same road we are, and then some states that are somewhat newer to the game. The unique part about this particular meeting is that we got to have one-on-one conversations with some of the gurus of health policy. So we got to sit down with one of the key designers of the exchange in Massachusetts. One of the Amy Lischko was in the state government there and was very integral in some of the design aspects. And then we followed that with an hour with Jonathan Gruber, who is one of the modelers of what they did in Massachusetts, as well as now working with California, and got to really talk, you know, kind of behind the scenes of stuff, and of stuff that you read about, but you got to ask more integral questions. And he also sits on the Health Exchange Board that is making a lot of the sort of more detailed decisions that weren't actually, you know, totally ironed out at the time that the legislation went through. So that those, and we got to speak with one of the lawyers who has sort of analyzed, you know, where are, you know, what's put you at risk for an ERISA challenge and what doesn't. So those were the kind of connections that we were able to make, and continue to network with this group over the next 18 months. And there's also some additional funding we will be able to apply for to perhaps get some additional consulting dollars to be able to get more of those kind of details, because we are, you know, certainly doing this on a shoestring. I was also invited yesterday, flying out on Sunday, to meet with a group of national folks from the Kaiser Family Foundation and Commonwealth Foundation, and actually there was representation from Heritage Foundation and several of the federal people who do a lot of data analysis for the Fed. And
if we might just
pause.
And if that happens again.
February should be interesting.
Well, maybe it'll be really short.
Yeah. That's turning big rocks into small.
But well, they had invited a handful of us states out to talk about what our data and informational needs would be from some of these folks that are doing some of this national stuff, but also having representatives from the federal government, AHRQ, HRSA, and people who do the Census Bureau data sets, you know, kind of how can we help you? But also realizing that we're a small state, and you know, California is very well represented in these national studies, but we're not. So, but they were, you know, Wisconsin was there, Delaware were there, other smaller states, and so we were able to communicate with them. It was an interesting observation that there were these large foundation representation from a California healthcare foundation, a Missouri healthcare foundation, Colorado healthcare foundation. Who are providing a lot of expertise and dollars to help these efforts in these other states. So we are at a somewhat of a disadvantage that we're not quite as well endowed with those aspects. But I would also felt better when I heard about Colorado, who is supposed to have their, they've had 39 proposals. They actually put out an RFI basically to the whole state and asked everyone to send in their favorite proposal. They narrowed it down from 39 down to kind of 4 key ones, and then they're essentially their equivalent of the health fund board created And they're in the middle of having all those five proposals modeled, but they have to finish all that up by the end of the year to present to their legislature by this January. So I didn't feel quite so bad. We had 350 days. But
I might interrupt you just a minute. I did receive an email with respect to the Lewins Group's work for Colorado. Was that discussed in terms of some of their preliminary findings?
The details of the findings were not discussed. A couple of their Blue Ribbon panel commission board member was there just to talk about kind of their needs, but there is ways to get input into what their analysis had showed. I also spoke with some of the folks from California because they had done their Senate Bill 2, which is the sort of the Democratic proposal as opposed to the Governor Schwarzenegger's proposal, has had quite a bit of analysis around it as well, and she's going to try to send me some of that. So I think there's a lot of networking possibilities to get the lessons learned and best practices sort of in these modeling exercises. Some other states, just to mention, is Wisconsin, along with some other states, are looking to do what is currently still in play is the universal coverage for kids, and then adding something on top of it for the working poor. While states like Colorado are looking kind of more broad, like we are, but the other common theme that everyone is looking at is evidence-based benefits, health information technology, and cost containment. And the challenges we talked about yesterday in D.C. were how there isn't a lot of evidence as to how effective some of these things are. I mean, medical home is new, relatively new, and so how can we capture some of these best practices and get some real data to show that these, it is cost effective. Sometimes it's a great idea. Preventive care has great evidence, but chronic care management we know has great evidence, but true prevention care doesn't really have that much evidence yet. But we think it's all a good thing to do. So it's just trying to get kind of what's your return on investment for improving these different aspects. I mean, how much savings can you get from doing these things as well? We know what we can get from quantifying that, both on a health care, what kind of return on investment in terms of health, and then return on investment from an economic perspective.
Question.
Yeah, a couple quick questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I know you're exhausted, so I'm not going to be hard here. The last point you talked about were the ones I wanted to hear about, too. Living 20 miles from California, I get half my news from California, unfortunately, and I have to listen to it. But they're suggesting, maybe, I thought they read 329 down there from what I could tell. But I think what happens here is that we're all being driven down kind of the same road, because that's where we'll have to go. And so there's a lot of similarity in these different programs. First question is, has anyone implemented any of this yet? My understanding, in Massachusetts, they've gone long ways, but they haven't really implemented their exchange completely yet. And their demographics are hugely different than ours as far as Medicare reimbursement, the percentage of uninsured compared to ours. So it's a different situation. And if we had their numbers, I think we'd have everybody insured already, but maybe not. That's one question. The second question you already touched on, and that's reduction of costs. And, we can look at any other first world country in the world. No, they do preventative care. They do primary care at a much higher level than we do, and their costs are half of ours. But that will not necessarily translate into our culture, a culture which has been developed that everybody wants a subspecialist maximum care for everything they've got wrong with them, and with a difficulty for some patients understanding they're responsible for their own health. So comment on both those, if you could, real quickly. And I know you're tired, but what was your sense from going to those meetings about whether or not, one, that any other state has actually gotten something accomplished, and two, what was the general feeling about cost containments?
Well, I'll start, and I think Bernie can add some about what they're thinking, having met with some folks in California recently. But Massachusetts is sort of phasing it in slowly. As I said, a lot of the nitty-gritty details weren't totally worked out before the legislation went through, so they're in the process of doing that. But they're phasing in the individual mandate is just, they've really just slowly getting into it, and they won't really see till probably April when it, the kind of the stick to have your individual mandate is your taxes, and so people won't really kind of get totally clued in that there will be some penalty for not being insured until April, but they started in July. The individual side, they have the four sort of subsidize the plans that are being subsidized. At the moment, they are limited to just four plans, and some of that was relation negotiations over having to preserve their disproportionate share dollars to those hospitals. But that's actually going to be phased out at some point. There won't be that focus that you only have to go to those four systems. So it is sort of like they're doing little parts of this. The small business part of the exchange isn't fully implemented yet, and it won't be right now. It's just the individual market that's in, is my understanding. But I think that California realistically is realizing their market is very different than Massachusetts. And
I had the opportunity a month or so ago to go to Sacramento for a day, and it was a private meeting that included representatives from the legislature and legislative staff, the governor's staff, and a number of both consultants and then California, some leaders in California healthcare. The meeting that Janine referenced in Chicago. My takeaway is what Massachusetts did has some very interesting concepts, but we first of all have to start, and you said it, Senator Bates, is the Massachusetts market is quite different from either California or Oregon. But there are, you know, there's a lot emerging in the California plan, and I'm told that, you know, there may be something within the short time that would probably be a referral for a ballot measure. But the same concept of an individual mandate of an exchange, the Massachusetts exchange is operational. It's not up to full speed, but it's got some really interesting website kinds of things. And so, you know, there's some learnings from Massachusetts that could be applied in different markets. You raise a very interesting comment about cost containment, because some states are moving toward universal to try to achieve universal coverage at the state level and not do much on cost containment. And actually, they will call that out. They will actually call it out and say, we're moving for coverage, not cost containment. We have, I mean, this is my personal opinion, and hopefully the board will endorse this. I believe we have to do both. We've already lived through a decade or more of a sound plan, the Oregon Health Plan, that really did not have the world changed on us with the Oregon Health Plan as far as cost containment and managed care, and we need to have sustainability on both the revenue side and on the expense side. And so I think we've got to do both. The conversations I've had with individual board members, some of whom are purchasers of care, private purchasers of care, they're saying the same thing: is that we need better value, we need more predictability, we need more efficiency, etc. I would say, and it just came to my mind, that there's one state in this nation that if we could learn from, if we could emulate what they've done, and Janine's heard me say this, it's the state of Minnesota. They have over a decade continued to move forward on both coverage and cost containment. Strong work between public and private purchasers on efficiency and effectiveness in the delivery systems. Their uninsurance rate is only 6%. It's very, their costs are, they're still working on costs, but they have a better cost trend than we have. We had the opportunity in Chicago to spend an evening at dinner with a number of the Minnesota representatives to talk about what their strategies were, and they're focusing totally on cost. That they're only going to achieve the next step of coverage when they can have a more predictable both state budget and private coverage. They're doing a lot with transparency of information for both providers, consumers, and purchasers. And it might be useful just for us conjointly between this subcommittee and maybe the board to have something in the spring where it could have a couple of people come out and talk about what Minnesota's done over the last 10 years, because they don't get a lot of fanfare. They don't get a lot of headlines. It's, you know, those kind of quiet Lutherans up there, Lake Wobegon. But when you read their statistics, I'm impressed with how how much they get done. And they have a rural, I mean, they have a state like us with rural and urban issues, lots of migration with new ethnicity, you know, in the northern plains. So it's just an interesting model for us to perhaps learn from and weave this all together, if not within the board's work, maybe some of the conversations in 2009.
Thank you. 6% is pretty impressive.
That is.
Mm-hmm. It's very impressive.
Over what time period?
I think Minnesota Care started back about the time the Oregon Health Plan did.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, follow-up question?
Yes.
Sure. Are their demographics in Minnesota similar to ours? I think they are. I think they've got a low Medicare reimbursement.
Yes. In fact, Minnesota was one of the states with Oregon and some others when we kind of put on the national campaign, because Senator Durenberger from Minnesota at the time was and our congressional delegation were all part of that unfairness of you penalize an efficient state through under-reimbursement and reward the profligate, which my dad always told me would happen.
Mm-hmm. It's also one of the, I think we were second behind Minnesota for the most heavily managed care states in the peak of managed care days.
Mm. What percentage of their population does not have coverage?
I think it's in the 6 to 7% range.
Yeah.
And they've worked. Well, my phrase is they work both sides of the ledger. They've worked the financing, but they've been really aggressive. And there's been a really strong partnership between public purchasers of care and private. Some of the large companies, General Mills and Honeywell, and things like that. So there's a real interest. And I see this. We're in an opportunity here in Oregon where a large sector of the Oregon business community is asking questions about how do we get greater value for our private dollar. Well, we're asking the same questions, I believe, on the public sponsorship side.
Okay. The question that I would have is, we've set a motion 329 that's made it quite a number of broad assumptions. Is there a point at which, before this thing is actually crafted into implementing legislation, that we would engage someone like the Lewin Group to do a kind of a proof analysis?
Well, let me comment on that, because I believe that a critical part of our work and one of my critical responsibilities is to put together, with Dr. Smith's help and others, to put together a small cadre of really nationally recognized professional folks that can analyze and model and give us good information. And I will tell you, I'm going after Jonathan Gruber. He's a professor of economics at MIT. And it's not just because Dr. Gruber was involved in Massachusetts. I'm more interested because he's been involved in the modeling in Massachusetts and the modeling in California and understands the differences in two markets. And so he's done some really good modeling work, and everybody that's worked with him says that's really informative and helps us think through issues. I'd also like to engage a guy like Rick Curtis from the Institute of Health Policy Solutions, who's worked on some of the insurance issues around the exchange and how an individual market with an individual mandate would be different. The bottom line for all of this, Senator Morse, I believe is what you, at least I took from your comment, is that I think we need to have really credible analysis that buttresses whatever recommendations come out of the board. People may not agree with the recommendations, but I think the analysis behind it, as far as modeling, econometric modeling, and there's one other piece I forgot, is that I think all of this has to be put into context, and I'm hoping to have the resources to find the resources to do this, is that to put any kind of reforms in healthcare also through an econometric model of what does it do to the vitality of Oregon's economy generally. Because I think we have to have both questions. I think the business communities and the taxpayer are going to want that. And I think there are firms, there are local firms that really know, understand the Oregon economy and how it moves and things. And if we can combine the Gruber types that are looking at healthcare with some really top-notch econometric stuff locally, we can get a better picture of what's the final impact. And I hope at the end of the day, if we do it right, there's a net positive. But I think that's the kind of analysis we need to be able to bring to all of you in 2009, and then people can disagree with the premises, but at least the professional analysis will have been done by a pro that knows what they're talking about. I'm not that, so.
Refresh our memory, if you would. What kind of resources did the legislature appropriate?
Total resources were $1.8 million, including federal match, but I do have $400,000 for consulting, and I am seeking, I've got cookie sales on the weekend, and I'm doing car washes in my garage. No, I am talking with some corporations and foundations. Janine mentioned that I believe that that RWJ, through its state coverage initiatives, will have some resources. So,
we'll take donations.
And we've got a pot of money that we can leverage, and I think there's some real interest. We had dinner with Dr. Gruber in Chicago. He is very excited to come to Oregon and do work in Oregon, to be able to understand now, with three kind of states looking at Massachusetts, California, and Oregon, and the difference of the demographics and the scale of the market and all of that. He's a really nice guy. He doesn't talk like an economist at all.
Actually,
so he talks.
He talks. Yeah. I mean, his only problem is Bruce Goldberg and I are Yankees fans, and of course he's from Boston. So.
Okay. Are there any other comments, questions, Senator? Last one.
Yeah, you know, maybe just a general comment, maybe help put all this in perspective a little bit. It's you know, look at where we're at and where we've come from. And, you know, you go back to April, May, and June, all of us, each and every one of us in this room, were wondering, are we even going to get a bill? And if we do, what does it look like? And all the challenges and the specific logistics. Oh, my God, how can we get an executive director, you know, in that short, and especially one that's worth its salt? And lo and behold, here's the perfect guy for the job. I mean,
I'm waiting for the other shoe.
Yeah, I am too. It's coming.
I know you too well. Is this serendipitous or providential?
No. This is very serious. And, you know, Barney's. We got Barney. And then everyone, the governor's never going to be able, you know, to appoint a 7-person board. It's not big enough. He'll never get consensus. And he did. Unanimously confirmed by the Senate. And then, you know, and it's a very capable board with absolutely the skills and acumen necessary to do the job. And had over 110 applications. Hottest ticket in town. And, you know, and many of those that didn't make the full board now sit and people the subcommittees. So, you know, we've really come a long way. And I could mention everyone in this room. And once you start that list, you don't stop. So the one guy I'm going to mention is sitting behind this dais, and Rick Prokovian never gets the accolades for helping make all this possible. So thank you for that, Rick.
Thank you. Very appropriate.
Yeah. Hold on, there's more. You know,
he's running
the other shoe. Here's the other shoe. You know, I attended the first meeting, as did Senator Morse, and I didn't hear this in the conversations that day, but several people commented to me that they did. And it's scope, it's vision. You know, is it going to be big enough? Are we working for the real solution? And that's what the board, indeed this legislature, is tasked with. It's really simple. You know, everybody's got to put some skin in this game. The winner can't be the last guy in the race to the bottom, because they'll still be at the bottom. You heard Dr. Bates say today the word revolution.
John Kitzhaber says revolution. We have got to revolutionize how we deliver health care. Otherwise, it's not going to happen, and it's not worth the journey. What we have done and started very well and given ourselves the opportunity to achieve must be continued. Just thanks, everybody. Very sincerely, thanks.
Well, thank you, Senator. Much work to be done. Again, I would reiterate, I believe this task, the task of this committee is to be complementary and to provide assistance where we can, fill in some of the gaps that may not be addressed quite as extensively in your work, all for the purpose of the end product. And so that's,
I concur.
Again, how can we help? That's,
concur.
That's where we're.
And we're refining our timing, but to your earlier conversation about the permanency or potential lack thereof of the subcommittee, is we're really, of this subcommittee, we're looking at some of these work groups and committees will get done faster than others, but we're really saying that the basic core recommendations need to be to the board somewhere between April 1st and April 30th, because the board's got to have at least 60 days. We need public hearings. So as we were thinking about that late winter, early spring, we'll probably be in a position to have conversations with the committee about emerging draft recommendations, et cetera. All of it, you know, the board takes under consideration at the end. But so we'll be working hard in November, a little bit in December, January, February, March, pushing real hard on all of the committees with, and probably a lot of this macro modeling that's in around the finance will go right up through the end as we look at different scenarios, and the board wants to look at things like that. So we'll keep you apprised, look forward to working with you.
Okay, well, thank you. Do you have something?
Just for a moment, and I just want to go back to a topic we talked about earlier. I want to get feedback from both of you what your sense of this is. You know, Senator Wessel's absolutely correct. 3 years ago, when he and I started this thing with an interim committee, we had to fight to get, and then we had to fight to maintain in the session, and then we got 329 out. Now it's got a lot of momentum, not only from what we've done, but from what the rest of the country is doing, so everyone's looking that this is the way to go. And I appreciate that, and I appreciate all the hard work that's been done to this point and what has to come next, too. It's always nice to be the person who saw it first and led people in that direction, but I'm still concerned, as Senator Wessel, I'm sure, is, and Senator Morris is, that we don't just have another big study group, and at the end, we have a report, and that's it. This has to be real this time. It has to be a real revolution. And to that point, we talked about involving the House, and obviously we have to ultimately involve the public, because some of this is very, very public policy. What's your sense? You're talking to three apostles here. I mean, we're already there, and a lot of the senators are there with us. And I think we probably have good representation in the Senate, who people who are in health policy are going to be very supportive through what 329 brings forth. I'm still concerned about the House and their lack of involvement in this. I don't want this to be seen as a Senate initiative. I want to see this as a legislative initiative supported by the governor. So what's your sense from the other side? Has there been great interest in seeing what the board's doing and what the board looks like and what the subcommittees look like? Is this sort of falling on deaf ears, or is there good momentum over there? If there isn't, we need to build that.
Senator Bates and Chair Morris, we did have some preliminary discussions as we were getting the team of eight of us to go out to Chicago. We had the Robert Wood Johnson folks came out, and we had this similar discussion around the table that day, and Representative Greenlick was there, and he had the same concerns and would like to figure out a means in which maybe we could have some early morning breakfasts or dinners or something where we could bring members who aren't as familiar with 329, and keep them a pace, a breath of what we're doing as we go through outside of a formal committee hearing sort of setting. So we'd be open to brainstorming on how best to accomplish that. But he had similar concerns of wanting to be sure that, you know, those who were on your committee and when you did the joint committee with his committee, you know, those guys know a lot and will want to know more detail, but we need a broader scope there.
Thank you. I think it's a job we're going to have to get done.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have been a little bit informal today, and I would like to invite any members present that have comments, suggestions, or questions to come to the table and express those. And I would extend that invitation if someone would so desire. This isn't an altar call. But if you have something you'd like to share, we'd like to hear it.
I've got a question of Barney, if that's possible.
Excuse me. You'll need to come to the and identify yourself for the record, please.
And I think others probably will have the same question.
Maybe you better come up, Barney, to answer it. And while they're getting situated, Mr. Chair, I would humbly suggest we do not invite Mary Beth Healy up to tell us about her new hot Mustang convertible.
Go ahead.
Jane, that boy from Portland. And my concern is how the general public can get informed of the committee hearings and the board hearings of the health fund board so that we can monitor, along with legislators, what's happening.
Very good question, Barney.
Yes, let me tell you what we've done to date and what we're hoping to do in partnership with others. We do have a website. Somebody described it to me as a vast wasteland. The word was desert.
A desert, okay.
And it is that in part because we're just getting started. But we will be every committee will have a website. Within that website, where we'll have all of the materials of the committee, the agendas, the materials that staff has developed, etc. Similarly with the board, we have and you can get to that website by going up in your address line and just type in healthfundboard.oregon.gov. We have an email that is directed at the address is ofhb.info@state.or.us. The intent of the email is for the public to be able to send in stories if they have comments on any material or anything they've heard in the committees. That's a communications vehicle. We're hoping to have some volunteer students who will monitor that so that we can summarize those things in the board on a regular basis. We'll see what's coming in through the email. At every meeting of the board and the committee, there will be at somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes reserved for public comment. The similar kinds of things that you've probably heard, you know, we urge things to be in writing and to summarize it, you know, two to three to five minutes so that everybody can speak. And then that will be part of the culture of the board and its committees. And the other is that we are working with a collaborative of interest groups and advocacy groups about other ways to involve the public, perhaps a third-party sponsored blog where much of the information that we would be made available would be open for comment and conversation among those that are interested in healthcare reform. And clearly, as we move from discussion and around recommendations and moving into kind of the recommendation phase, we intend within the budget to go out state and have meetings and it's, you know, within the budget and the time that's available so that we can engage the public in here's what the board's thinking about, here's the draft recommendations, and give us your comments so that the board can take that into consideration as we kind of fine tune this about a year from now. The communications and outreach strategy is very important to me. I think there's two parts to this to be successful. We have to have good content and credibility with what we
actually do as staff and what the board moves on to the legislature, and we need to do it in a process that the public feels that they have access to it, they can see it, they can comment on it, good or bad. We're going to try to meet those values. I'm glad Jane raised the issue.
Yeah, but what about those who don't have computer access?
Are you talking about TV hearings or things like that? I mean, we're working within the framework of the resources we've got available.
So if we don't have computer access, we're out of the picture.
We can call and we can send.
There's a website, or I mean, there's call Janine, call me. There's a telephone number. That all the material that if somebody doesn't have it available, but can't get it electronically, we'll make it available in hard copy. We'll send. I mean, we have a listserv that people can sign up for, so that all of the meetings notifications will be sent electronically. And if somebody doesn't have any of those electronic communications via computer, they can call us regularly, and we'll be able to tell them when and where the meetings are. And I believe that other organizations will be monitoring us too, so I think there's going to be a web of, announcements that here's what's going on.
Do you have a link to the legislature so that if someone goes into the legislature's agenda, like notice for these hearings, that someone could readily gain access to your scheduled hearings? And I think that's part of the question, is how do we make sure that
from the fund board to OHPR, we've got links there, and then there are other links, but we can work on trying to make sure that wherever anybody kind of gets into the healthcare reform discussion, whatever portal or door they go through, they could ultimately find us.
The Oregon State Legislature's website has Oregon Gov's link, and then all the state agencies, including our link just vis-a-vis Oregon Gov. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Does anyone else wish to make comments, suggestions?
Can I ask Rick Bennett come here just for a second? I have a question for him.
Pardon?
I'd like to ask Rick Bennett to come up just for a second.
Sure.
I'd like to ask him a question. A couple of questions. It's not, Rick, it's not bad.
Well, that is a picture of enthusiasm.
It's a risk of...
I'm so glad to see you again, Rick. You're so excited to be here, I can tell.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being called up. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for ARP Oregon.
Chair, thank you. Rick, I touched on something earlier today about Medicare, and it's something that's really new and novel for me, being a healthcare professional. And I've asked people in my particular area what's going on. And this disenrollment of Medicare patients it's from primary care, I should have mentioned before, too. It's not happening in subspecialty or specialty care. It's happening in primary care. And before it's been, I smooth the state, I can't get anyone to take me as a Medicare patient. Now it's people turning 65, they get their Medicare, and suddenly they don't have a doctor anymore. They haven't got primary care anymore. I'm assuming it's something that's going on in certain particular states where Medicare reimbursements are very, very low, but is it something the AARP has any track on? What are you seeing? What's your sense about it? Is it pockets of Oregon? Is it nationwide? I know in Pendleton, half the doctors in primary care no longer take Medicare patients. I don't know if they disenrolled those they already had. And I know in our part of the country, it's becoming a serious problem. And apparently in Portland, about half the primary care physicians won't see Medicare patients. What's AARP's sense of it, if they have one? What do you know?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, we're very much concerned about this issue as well. I don't think Oregon is necessarily unique. It perhaps greater severity here, again, because of reimbursement rates and so forth. In the short term, of course, we're very concerned about additional reductions in physician payments coming up in January. And we've been working with the American Medical Association to get those cuts rescinded. That was originally part of the discussion in the House related to both the Children's Medical Insurance Program, and of course that the Medicare provisions were were removed before going to the president and being vetoed, but AARP and the American Medical Association, along with many other organizations, are still working to see some type of legislation passed before the end of the year that will deal with not only the physician reimbursement, but also a few other issues related to low-income beneficiaries and Part D prescription drugs, and a couple other items as well. But I think that's a short-term solution. Clearly, we need to be looking at not only Medicare, but the entire healthcare delivery system. And that's a discussion we've had on several occasions over the past year.
Follow-up. And part of those discussions at the federal level, do you know if the disparity between reimbursements and between the various states is part of that discussion, or is that something that's not being discussed?
I don't think, not immediate. I think this is something we do have to move forward on, but I think the immediate issue is the fact that if nothing is done, I think that previous legislation that was approved by Congress calls for like a 10% reduction in physician reimbursement, and we're seeking to make sure that's rescinded. But that's a stopgap, really. And I hear from our members on a fairly regular basis somebody calling our office seeking some kind of resource. Where can I go to get a primary physician? And it's difficult to take those kind of phone calls because you don't really know for sure how to answer them. There aren't that many options out there.
Okay. Thank you, Rick, for stepping up. I appreciate it. And you were. You didn't have a chance to get prepared for this, and I didn't know you'd be here. My concern really is this. We're trying to produce a primary care model in the state. A reduction in pay for a certain provider becomes very significant if you're the lowest paid provider to start with. And I'm afraid that we're going the absolute opposite direction we should be in Medicare, and that a reduction across the board is something that's not acceptable. There was a discussion earlier about actually raising rates for primary care and lowering for specialty care. And I know that's still part of the discussion. If that, in fact, were the policy, there would be some value to it, some real value to it. But you still have to solve the problem of disparity between the states. If you end up in a state with half the Medicare population not having primary care, other states have a complete, we've got a national problem that we really can't deal with. It has to be dealt with at the national level, and we would ask organizations like AARP to help us with that. You're a national organization.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, one additional comment. One of the concerns AARP has had related to Part B reimbursement and physician reimbursement is, in fact, that the beneficiaries pay 25% of that Part B cost. And so any increase in the cost of the program, including increased reimbursement for physicians, increases beneficiaries' premiums. And over the past 5 or 6 years, you've seen, I think, like, nearly 100% increase in those premiums, and they're very close to $100 a month individuals have to pay, or they lose their benefit, and $100 a month for many people is a substantial amount. So resolve the issues related to physician reimbursement at the same time trying to find some control related to premiums is not an easy problem to solve.
Thank you.
I can counterpoint by saying in low-income Oregonians, premiums paid for by Medicaid, but I understand. Thank you.
Impacts medical students and their career choices.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it does.
And the whole workforce.
Yep. You're right back to workforce.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Rick. Thank you.
Okay. Hearing nothing more from the committee or members present, close the hearing.
Thank you.